There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, our daily podcast that brings together the very best bits of today's show from Sunday, November the 10th. In particular, the fact that we've got a long holiday at the end of November over the National Day weekend, it's been confirmed that both the public and the private sector are going to get the Sunday, the Monday and the Tuesday off, depending, of course, on your circumstances and what business you work in. We know that some people will be working that weekend, but nevertheless, for office workers and the like, typically, it's a five-day weekend and we've got at least a month's notice to plan. So we're asking, have you taken advantage of this advance notice? Because we know for years, decades, it's been one of those things that we've griped about to the letters page in 7 days or over a cup of coffee, isn't it? Why don't we get more notice? Well, now you've got it. And in the business breakfast, what have we done about it?
Nothing yet.
Yeah, I've thought about it an awful lot. Does that count?
Well, I've kind of done. I have booked something. Because I've got my dad coming over that weekend. And he booked his flights last week. So when I saw that it was this weekend, he was going to come the previous weekend. I thought, no, come that weekend because the kids will be off school. You get to spend more time with them and we can go somewhere. So we booked to go to Calba up in the Mussendam.
Kassab.
So, are you taking the children camping again?
No, we've booked a nice hotel. We did go camping a year and a half ago. That was a one-off.
That's the main hotel up there, is it? On the edge of the water, overlooking the straits?
It's near that one. Oh. That used to be the Golden Tulip, didn't it?
Yes, that's right.
And
that's
it's now been taken over by the Omani government, which has created their own brand, and I've forgotten the name. It begins with A, and they've got a couple of them, and there's one around the corner. So basically, yes, it's there. So
it'll
we're going to stay there.
Perfect weather to go onto a dhow and go around to Telegraph Island and the fjords around there. What a great trip.
We've booked the dhow. I'm not convinced about my 83-year-old dad, unsteady on his feet, on a dhow. Yeah. But, you know, it could go either way.
Do you remember that road up there is world class between the sea and the mountains, the big steep cliffs. And I did it once in that soft top Volvo that I had. And that is going along that road in a soft top is brilliant.
Do you think I should rent a convertible for the weekend?
If you can, yeah.
We'll do that with a support vehicle.
Kids would love it.
But I also read over the weekend, actually, that Oman has now insisted that everybody who's going across the border from the UAE, for anywhere, in fact, gets a visa in advance. Because the last time I went there, the faffing about at the border was an hour and a half each way. But then when I went to Jebel Akhdar a few weeks ago, we booked the visa in advance, and it's still a 15 to 20 minute
visa.
Yeah, book it online in advance, 5 riyals, 50 dirhams, whatever it is.
That's all you have to do.
Yeah. So there's still a bit of faffing, but nowhere near as much faffing as there used to be. So looking forward to that. So I've booked, is that a stay? I think that's a staycation,
though
technically it's international. If you're driving there, I think it's staycation territory.
And there has been, as you say, a big announcement saying that you have to get your visas now in advance, e-visas, if you are going to Oman. I was reading that this morning. The last time I was looking at going to Oman, I did the thing online. And I wasn't quite sure how long it was going to take, so I phoned them. And this was last year. They said, "Oh no, you could just turn up." I said, "Really? Because it looks like I should do it online." They said, "No, come and try. Good luck." To which I thought, "I'm not sure." It's like strike out for the border. That good luck is what I'm going to go on. They have, and it's been a system of integrating that, hasn't it? Of moving from the mix of online and physical visas, you know, get them on the border visas. And now they say, and they've tweeted, in fact, in the last, I think, 24 hours, that it's only going to be exceptional cases that they'll be doing sort of visas on the spot. You need to get an e-visa if that's what you're looking at for your staycation.
Does that make it harder or easier?
Oh, easier. Not easier. I've done both.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Right. And also just knowing it's done, you're in good stuff.
Don't forget the insurance certificate for your car. We didn't and managed to blag it, but that's not a strategy. Hope is not a strategy.
Because most insurance policies here include Oman, don't they? They're built in, but you've got to take the paper with you or something that shows you've got that insurance.
Something like that. We've been speaking to the guys at Donata about this. Omeya Atrash is a product manager for UAE retail at Donata Travel, the big travel agency. And we've been asking her about not just this particular weekend, but this strategy announced back in March to align the holidays of the public sector and the private sector. And we've been asking her what changes they've seen to the way that we book our holidays.
Normally, regardless of the time of the year or the holiday, approximately 45% of all our bookings were booked and travelled within 14 days. Now, in comparison, 3 years ago, this would have been 75% book and travel within 14 days. So there's definitely been improvement in people trying to book in advance.
That's still quite lastminute.com, isn't it?
No, it is. I'm actually going away this weekend. I've got two nights on the creek this weekend. And I will probably be inspired in the next few weeks to go off somewhere for that 5 days.
Don't complain to me about not having enough notice for holidays if you're not booking in advance. Says the girl who's not going anywhere.
Well, you might decide later, nearer the time, to do that.
I'm moving flat, so I've actually already earmarked that weekend for... Exactly, for unpacking and sorting.
Yeah. Zubair's been in touch. Lots of messages about this. Yeah. Thanks very much indeed. Zubair says that when you have children, you've got to plan in advance.
As soon as it was announced in March, I saw that there's, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday off, so I figured it's just take 2 days, Wednesday, Thursday off, and... you can get yourself a full 9-day holiday. So I decided to book Bangkok, Phuket. There's no rule my side in terms of how far I can go, but it's just I have three kids. So the less travel or less hours travel, the better. Phuket is probably about a 6 hours direct flight from Abu Dhabi.
There you go. That is Zubair. And Richard's been on a plane over the weekend. I mean, you were here on Thursday morning on the show and you're here now. But you've been away in the meantime.
I have. Short flight to Riyadh for the weekend.
First time ever?
First time ever in Saudi Arabia. 21 years in this country.
Tell us.
Surprisingly, enjoyed it.
Yeah?
There's an awful lot to see and do there.
What did you get up to?
So a couple of things. The main reason I was there was for something called Saudi Design Week. Ooh. It's Dubai Design Week this week. Yeah, wife's an architect, so that's kind of our bag. And we use this as an excuse. We've been thinking about going for a while, and we thought, well, let's go this weekend because it kind of chimes with what we do. We weren't doing anything there or exhibiting. We just went to have a look what was happening. So that was the first thing we did. And I briefly caught up with the organizer of that event. Now, it's 6 years old. She's called Basma Bouza. And she says she's really seen a change over the past few weeks, over the past few years, in the approach from the authorities. She says when she started off, it was really hard to get all the permits, you know, this stamp from this department and approval from this department. But she says now the government is so keen to promote events like this that it's much more smooth. She says, on the one hand, you've got the big financial deals, like the multi-squillion trillion dollar IPO of Aramco, but they're really focusing on what she calls soft power. Things like design, things like arts, things like culture. She says the government recognises that they're really, really important. This is what Basma told me.
If you look at the different entities like the Ministry of Culture and who are celebrating design and different assets of it, you kind of look at people celebrating soft power, celebrating culture, celebrating change that is happening through something tangible.
And the other change she's seen is socially at the event. For example, people walking around, many people not wearing abayas. The women not wearing abayas. My wife took an abaya, borrowed one, wore it, put it on the plane when we got there, wore it at the airport, took it off in the taxi and never put it on again. Now, you covered your arms and your legs because you're wearing long dresses with long sleeves. But apart from that, everything's absolutely fine. And Basma says you see that. You see these changes. You have live DJs playing loud music. And that's now the norm there.
I think you see people getting more comfortable in their skin, where it used to be such a rarity to see intermingling of sexes in one event. Now it's like the norm to have like music playing in the background. And it's even a necessity in an event to kind of have all of the different edutainment parts of the event. So it's, I think, a reverberation of everything that's changing in the culture itself found in one event.
It's Basma Bouzma of Saudi Design Week.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
You say you want a revolution.
Going to hear now from the man who quite literally invented the concept of the fourth industrial revolution. a decade ago in Germany, former IBM executive Henrik von Scheel coined the phrase Industry 4.0 to describe the combined effect on the German economy of things like artificial intelligence and nanotechnology, modern versions of the printing press or the cotton spinner. Now, there is some confusion here because it's a different German-speaking professor, World Economic Forum boss Klaus Schwab, who often gets the credit for popularizing the term Fourth Industrial Revolution, but the real brains behind it was Henrik von Scheel. Now, he's a regular visitor to the UAE, and he was in Dubai recently for a mini version of the World Government Summit. I sat down with Henrik, who began by recording the time he spent with German Chancellor Angela Merkel 10 years ago refining the concept.
So when we did the strategy for Germany, it took nearly 8 weeks where we, every second day, we were together, had lunch in the evenings, and we talked about strategy, right? She really went in depth to understand what is it we need to change. And she was open and willing to think. She's one of the great leaders because she took time to think. Most leaders I've been sitting together with, they just want to have the solution, right? And many times when you lead a country, there's no solution to buy. The boldest step she ever did is that she killed her favorite child that she had in her stable. The child that gave 70% of productivity level, she decided that the combustion engine, the greatest invention that Germany has done, she looked at me and said, I think I'll make that step. That is a bold, bold step. And I see the same thing here in Dubai. It will not come easy. Why? Because they're not used to it. Thinking is a process where you look at the whiteboard and you don't have a solution.
No one from McKinsey is giving you the three key takeaways.
No. They do the best practices. They sell what they sell to the other one, right? Thinking requires you sit on the whiteboard and you really think, saying, what is possible? Why not this? See, crazy idea to kill the greatest child you have in your own home that surprised the biggest food. That's an outrageous, stupid thought, right? But that requires you have to think about what will be the replacement for it.
So, Henry, let's talk about this idea of the Fourth Industrial Revolution. I'll be candid. I'm convinced it's a big deal, but a lot of people think it's just hot air and hype and buzzwords. So explain to us in simple terms, what is the Fourth Industrial Revolution from the perspective of the person who invented the very concept, and then convince a sceptical audience that it's not just buzzwords and hype, that it's actually important.
So if we want to make the Fourth Industrial Revolution like idiot-proof, totally idiot-proof, because sometimes my wife says, can you not just make it a little bit simpler? I says, yes, I can. It's the colliding of three worlds together. The digital world, the physical world, and the virtual world. This is the Fourth Industrial Revolution. There are 17 technology sets, and they're arriving in three distinct waves. The first wave has already happened. That's augmented reality, that's robotics, that's cloud, that's 3D printing, that's IoT or digitalization. The second wave is focusing on artificial intelligence, which is, when we say it simple, it's the automation of intelligence. It has been around for a very long time. When you had your first the calculator, that's the simple version of artificial intelligence. It will control every aspect of our life.
Okay, and you say that also part of this second wave is smartphones and communications.
Then you have G6, and I call it by design G6 communications because we have been fooled a little bit by the telecommunications providers. They are providing us 5G, which is 4G, old wine and new bottles. 5G should be 1 terabyte upload and 1 terabyte download, and we are not even getting close to 50 megabyte upload and download. And why is 6G important? Because we need for smart city to work a very strong communication infrastructure, new energy sources, renewable energy sources. Climate change, in essence, is the shift of water cycles. We have blockbuster ice melts, we have blockbuster hurricanes, blockbuster droughts, blockbuster floods. It's all the shift of water that is changing.
Okay, so that's waves one and two. What's the third and final wave, Henrik?
Then we have the third wave. The third wave is about new industries emerging. Quantum technology, bioinformatics, nanotechnology, advanced materials. So these, for many people, this sounds like science fiction. But I'm telling you, each of you who listen to this, we need to focus on how we produce food, how we ship food, how we consume food. I need to change my way how I eat meat. I love the Impossible Burger. We are killing more animals than ever before. So just to give you some facts around it, the last 15 years, we have killed 25% of animals that are on the planet. By 2025, we have killed additional 25. That means we have managed by 30 years to kill 50% of animals that are alive. We need to change the way we need to get off oil, off coal, off gas. The blessings we have before are not the blessings we will have in the future.
It's the voice of Henrik von Scheele, the German tech guru who coined the phrase, indeed invented the concept of the fourth industrial revolution, speaking to me recently in Dubai.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-sized Business Breakfast. Newsmakers.
The people making the headlines today.
Starting with NASA, Malcolm.
Yeah, NASA, of course, when you think NASA, you think the National Aeronautics and Space Administration in the US, the people that took people to the moon, and that space is their big thing. But in the last couple of days, they've announced a thing called X-57 Maxwell. X-57 Maxwell. All of their experimental planes over the years have had the X tag on them. X-1, for instance, was the bullet shaped bell that first broke the sound barrier. The X-15 rocket plane was flown by Neil Armstrong before he joined the Apollo moon team. So you think of them as being fast and space. What the X-57 Maxwell is actually it's a propeller plane.
Okay.
A propeller plane. They've gone backwards, so you might think. It's going to have 14 engines on its wings, and it is going to be an alternative fueled flight. Have a listen to their explanation of what X-57 Maxwell is.
Now, the X-57 is not the first all-electric airplane, and it's not the first one to use a whole lot of different motors, but it's the first airplane. It's a flight demonstrator, actually, for a particular technology that we call distributed electric propulsion technology.
So what does that mean, distributed electric propulsion?
So it means that we have a number of different electric motors distributed all along the wing here, and they each have a little bit of different purpose, but all together, when you put this on this airplane, we think that it'll give you up to a 5 times reduction in energy used for this airplane compared to a conventional gasoline-powered airplane.
5 times, that seems like an awful lot.
That's a spokesman for NASA, and saying that this new 14-engine plane will be powered alternatively. It'll be power packs, maybe solar. It's going to have lightweight wings, and it's going to have small lift props along the leading edge of every wing, plus some cruise props at the tip of each wing, and that's going to be activated for takeoffs and landings. But because electric motors are more compact with fewer moving parts than the big internal combustion engines we're used to, they're simpler to maintain and weigh a lot less. So what NASA think they've got here is something that could be adapted to carry passengers in the future, because it takes less energy to fly. Obviously, when you've got people in them, they're going to have to up the power of the engines, but they're also much quieter than conventional engines as well. One challenge is, of course, the improving battery technology. You've got to store the energy on the plane, because you're not going to be able to charge it by solar as it goes along. So they're envisaging this to start with short-haul flights such as air taxis or maybe commuter flights, and then roll it out to the wider world as the technology improves. But the X-57 Maxwell is my newsmaker this morning from NASA, and because you can have as many sort of pie-in-the-sky projects for electric-powered taxis and whatever it may be, self-drive this and that and the other, but this is real. This is NASA getting involved, and they will finish this.
Other newsmakers that we're looking at this morning, Brady Scott, Santa Claus. Aren't we about 6 weeks too early?
No, we're not in the slightest. Not if you shop at Harrods, but only if you spend enough at Harrods.
It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas everywhere you go.
Harrods, has a Swarovski crystal encrusted grotto. It has 10 centres on rotation, 3 working at once cleverly in different sections of the grotto so that the children only ever see one centre. And in order to be able to buy a £20 ticket to take your child to see centre, you have had to spend £2,000 during the year.
Okay, I was thinking 20 quid, 80 dirhams, not that much.
And there has been outrage. And Harrods has agreed to change its policy, but only a little bit. Here's the story. Harrods had a free grotto when it introduced it in 1955. The grotto has been very popular. They now restrict access to people who've spent basically, from what I can figure out, 2,000 quid during the year. So you have to be a certain tier on the Harrods reward card.
Which is not very much, is it? £2,000 over the year in a shop that you can buy just about everything at. It's not much.
So those are the only people who get the opportunity to book tickets. And there's been a lot of people saying, look, we've got a family tradition. We visit the grotto every year. We want to be able to buy a £20 ticket like everybody else. This is basically penalising anyone whose parents can't spend £2,000 in Harrods. Harrods' way of dealing with this has been to kind of have a little bit of a grotto lotto where they've put people's names in a wishing well and drawn 10 a day. So they have 160 slots for people who haven't paid 2,000 quid effectively during the year.
They're frequent shoppers at Harrods. It's a bit like saying Emirates can't, why can't I go into your first class lounge because I haven't flown enough miles? I mean, this is, you qualify, and if it's going to be busy and they need to weed people out and keep the numbers down a bit, then why not give priority to your frequent shoppers or frequent flyers? I see that as being perfectly logical.
I think it's a little bit different when it's kids in centre. Rich, as children who has children,
He is a child who has children.
I'm all of the above. I'm torn, but the kangaroo court is going to come down on the side of Harrods with this, because it is a bastion of wealth and elitism, isn't it? That's kind of the point. Harrods has never, whoever's been owning it, claimed to be
populist,
egalitarian. It's just not. So yeah, you reward your frequent flyers, and I take Malcolm's point about Emirates or 5-star hotels that have amazing kids clubs. Yes, they charge. That's the business model.
But they are charging. That's the point. There's a £20 ticket per person, but it's just that you're not allowed to buy the tickets unless your parents have reached a certain point in the programme.
I presume they're not doing this to sort of invent some eliteness around the whole process. They're doing it to keep the numbers down because they've got so much demand, I presume.
They have said that every year they are overwhelmed by requests, we want to make the grotto as magic as possible, this is how many slots we can facilitate, let us know what you think this morning.
Or their da-da-da-da-das?
They're mine, because okay. Otherwise I'm going to be reading out a very long statement. They do, incidentally, make nearly £85,000 from the grotto every year with the £20 tickets.
Nice bonus for how many centres was it?
10 centres.
10 centres.
My newsmaker this morning is Mike Bloomberg not announcing, throwing his hat into the ring for US president. This technical thing, the Alabama primary, he's registered for that. He had to do it by Friday. It's a technical symbolic thing, but it means he is considering a run to be the Democratic candidate for the US presidential election this time next year. What I like almost more than Mike Bloomberg, who hasn't said anything about this, is the response, and I know you picked up on this, Malcolm, by Donald Trump.
He doesn't have the magic to do well. He will not do very well. And if he did, I'd be happy. There is nobody I'd rather run against than little Michael, that I can tell you.
It's just odd language. I mean, little Michael. Do you really demean your political opponents in a country like America?
Yes, it's been going on for some time now.
But, yeah, I don't know.
This is the man who ran on a platform of having big hands and being good at golf.
I don't know. I guess that will probably rile up Mike Bloomberg supporters, maybe, and maybe he'll have a chance at the Democrats. I don't know. The nomination, I mean, it's a fairly lackluster field. Some of the candidates being seen as too left for middle America. So I don't know. I don't know how popular he is in America.
Well, I was listening to a few podcasts over the weekend with various commentators debating this. And the one camp says, no, the Democrats are running on a ticket of being far more egalitarian, of reducing the income gap, of being more equal. To have the eighth richest man in America, Mike Bloomberg, with a personal fortune of $54 billion, representing that movement is just absurd, and there's no way it can happen. But others are far more generous, and they say a couple of things. One, apparently, I didn't know this, Mike Bloomberg has one of the most sophisticated private polling systems in the world. He pays an absolute fortune for it. So he knows two things. One, that the current candidates, like Elizabeth Warren or Joe Biden, can't win against Donald Trump. And two, that actually he does have enough support. That's what his internal polls tell him. And if it wasn't for that, he wouldn't have thrown his hat into the ring.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Let's get some more insight now on one of the world's top stories this weekend. It is the 30th anniversary of the falling of the Berlin Wall, and this is the unofficial anthem of that event. Winds of Change by the Scorpions, they were certainly blowing through Berlin 30 years ago. One Dubai resident who was there is Yvonne Ludica, and she joins us now on the line. So take us back to that moment 31 years ago now when the wall came down. Describe what you were doing that day. You were a teenager, you were at school.
I was at, I can remember that very, very, very vaguely because we were actually writing our exams for the A-level graduation. And it was cold, and it was like we knew something was going on, and we said, do we have to go to school and everything? But I was actually writing my exams, and then all of a sudden we were told, I said, okay, fine, because of some happenings taking place, and we heard it in the news, we would have been given 2 days off school. So what happened actually, it was actually on the 9th of November, towards the evening, we and my friends, we gathered together, and we went actually downtown to Berlin, and then all of a sudden we saw all these people coming in, and we were just like, we cannot believe that is actually happening. And I grew up with the wall my whole life, but my family, my parents, they were like, they could not even imagine. So we had the sheer amount of people walking in there, and we just had a celebration. For us, it was great because we had, you know, a few days off school because we didn't have to do the exams. But it was nice to see something together. And one of my friends said to me, we are writing history today. And of course, when you're young, 18 years old or 17 years old, you don't even think that way. You just say, oh my God, it's just a big celebration. But actually, we were writing history on that night.
And when the wall went up, I mean, families were divided, just depending on where you happened to be in Berlin at that particular time, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, we had in our family a case because my grandfather's birthday was on the 13th of August. And the 1961 in the evening when the wall was actually built, it was his birthday celebration. So he had a lot of, you know, family and friends coming over to celebrate with him. And some people at night could not go back to the West because he was deciding to celebrate. And that was part in the East part of Berlin. And some people came for the celebration, of course, stayed a little bit longer because, you know, they wanted to celebrate. And then the next day, they could not go back. So some had to stay, so which was very tragic, and some were able to go back.
Suddenly nobody they became recognized East Germans.
East Germans. So that it was just, some of the West could go back, but even then some of the people who were in West Germany could not even go even back to East Germany, even though later then it was being able. But it was quite a tragedy, and he always felt guilty, but nobody knew about this. What was happening. He just had his birthday on the 13th of August, which was a round birthday, and everybody came in.
So Yvonne, you were raised in West Germany, and you grew up about 10 years off. You were born about 10 years after the wall was built.
Yes.
What was it like growing up in West Germany? Because it was this tiny little enclave in the middle of the communist Soviet world. We've heard all types of things about the Berlin blockade and how supplies were brought to you. What was life like in that little enclave, in that little bubble?
Well, we did not, to be honest with you, we West Berliners, we didn't feel like we were in that little bubble and everything. The only thing is because when you grew up with this wall, because there are certain parts of Berlin when you go and all of a sudden there's a wall and nobody could understand that. So when you had people coming over, we called it then the Wessis from West Germany, coming over and say, okay, show us the wall and everything. For them, it was, you know, quite of a highlight. For us, we grew up with this. It was just funny to see because some of the U-Bahn or the metro station or the S-Bahn, we will call it, they, when you ride some of the trains, some part of the trains were actually running through East Berlin, but you could not get out of this. So you saw actually, when you drove to some of the parts in Germany, you taking metro or the U-Bahn or the S-Bahn, and you couldn't even stop because that was East German railway station. So that was one part of it. But it was a bit challenging for us when we wanted to go to West Berlin, because I remember we were on a field trip, and every time you had to, when you have to leave Berlin, drive through the zone, it was called the East German zone, you were checked, you were questioned and everything, and then you drive all the way to West Germany. So that was something, I would say, challenging, not knowing, and then you felt like, you know, what is happening? You live in a city, you want to go to another part of the country, and you have to drive through a very, you know, frightening zone. And that was then, that reminded you most of the time that you are in a city which is divided.
Yvonne, settle a business breakfast argument for us this morning. We've been discussing what was the actual theme for the falling of the Berlin Wall. When we introduced you just now, we played Scorpion's Winds of Change.
That was one part of it. But the main part is, like you mentioned it before, David Hasselhoff, I've been looking for freedom.
Yeah, because he played in a crane hanging above the wall, didn't he, after it came down? And he's just been back 2 days ago to perform as well.
Yeah, and at the moment, that's what I'm watching. Unfortunately, we don't have German TV here, but thanks to the internet, you can, you know, watch everything. But actually, when the wall came down, it was not at the Brandenburg Gate, because the Brandenburg Gate was one of the latest ones when they opened it. That was only opened on the 22nd of December, when then German Chancellor Helmut Kohl finally, you know, arrived, and then he had this walk through the gate. So the first opening was at the Checkpoint Charlie. And funny enough, everybody... Friedrichstrasse, because these are the ones. Yeah. And funny enough that I've been looking, David Hasselhoff was performed on that night when we had the big celebration, I think 22nd December. And that is the anthem. That is what people are, you know, always referring to. That's why David Hasselhoff has such a great connection with Germany and the Germans with him as well.
And he's probably got the heritage as well with a name like Hasselhoff,
yeah.
I guess.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yvonne, it's been great talking to you. Appreciate you joining us. Yvonne Ludeker was born and raised in Berlin. She was there when the Berlin Wall came down 31 years ago now. That's it for the Bite Size Business Breakfast. We're back tomorrow morning from 6 a.m. with the Business Breakfast Breakfast.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.